thing well as an axiom.
So repairing engineering, yes.
Is that on actually?
Is it on? I think it should be on.
Okay.
So, I mean, so there are things unified insofar as they're connected to the topic of inflation. So, cosmological inflation is sort of our paradigm or sort of best idea we have for early universe physics. Because it explains otherwise puzzling features of the universe, like the isotropy, homogeneity, flatness, and a mechanism to sort of enter the Big Bang era, and as well as providing a means to settle the fluctuations in the universe, primarily adiabatic, Gaussian, approximately scattering variance. But inflation probably occurred at extremely high energy scales, much higher than we can probe directly in accelerators, or even in astrophysical phenomena. And so we're left wondering, sort of, what is the mechanism behind inflation? What are its details? What is its Lagrangian? And even if we did know that, what would we really learn? We'd like to know, how does it connect to fundamental physics? How does it constrain microphysics? And these sort of challenging questions, to get some answers of them, are probably going to require a combination of input from theory, experiment, and observation. And I'm sort of going to be talking about two topics sort of related to this. So first we're going to be talking about trying to embed inflation in candidates of theories of quantum gravity, like string theory. And I'll be talking about a sort of a corner of the string landscape, is type 2A theory. And we'll see sort of the zeroth order that the type 2A theory and typical string theories sort of provide the ingredients for inflation in four-dimensional description of sort of zeroth order. But we want to do better than that. We want to achieve slow roll inflation. And I'll prove that in this corner, that a particular corner of this that I'll describe that we understand very, very well, and that was the reason for studying it, there's this no-go theorem that this corner has absolutely no inflation. And so in some sense, inflation constrains string theory beyond the constraints that you'll find from demanding sensible particle physics. And now, in some sense, these are sort of top-down approaches always have the problem that it's difficult to connect to low-energy phenomena. And this gives me an excuse to talk about an old but sort of alive topic, which is axiom cosmology, which is sort of a beautiful example of really high-energy physics reaching down and being relevant to low scales. And inflation plays a central role here, in fact. And I'll talk about the observational constraints that we mapped out, gravity waves, stars, dark matter, elastic curvature fluctuations, and talk about sort of the classic window on this and the anthropic window where inflation is central. Okay, so let's begin with this topic. So, cosmologists, you know, are asking various interesting questions, some of which are that inflation did occur, then what is the inflaton potential, what is its Lagrangian, and even more basically, what is the inflaton, where does that come from? And string theorists are asking questions like, where in the space of string models is our universe, and what can be predicted by string theory? And it's possibly the case that the very early universe is at very high energies is a place where cosmology and string theory can make connections to one another. And in our first paper, we tried to advocate this by including this Stringlish to English dictionary for cosmologists, so people like me who claim to be experts in string theory. So
which one was a Stringlish, which was not English?
You have to look at it a little bit. So inflation in very basic terms, how do you implement inflation, which as probably all know is this period of the early universe undergoing exponential expansion from many e-foldings. And the simplest way to do this is to introduce to postulate Lagrangian, where we have usual Einstein-Hilbert term, and then introduce some new scale of phi carrying a kinetic term and some potential V of phi. And this is going to act like an approximate cosmological constant for a while. Now, if we're not interested in the underlying microphysics, of the potential, then we can more or less make it up. And so I draw something, for example, like this. And so here, the potential here is sort of flat-ish in some sense. And that will sustain a period of exponential expansion acting like a quasi-cosmological constant. And this flatness is measured by this Westerdahl parameter, which you probably all know, the derivative of not just the potential, but the log of the potential squared needs to be small, this being measured in Planck units. Now this is if you have one field. If there are multiple fields, then in fact, it's sort of the gradient squared needs to be small. So you take derivative of each of the directions in field space, and they all have to be small. And so, yeah, so that it's not just enough to have one flat direction, you need several as far as the first derivative is concerned. And then if this ends at some point...
That's one that includes many fields. I mean, this is not true.
Yes, it is true. If you have, say, a bunch of scalar fields, let's say, for example, they carry canonical kinetic energy, right? Then you sum up all these guys here. This,
but what do you actually mean? You mean the adiabatic direction, you mean the derivative in the direction where the field is actually rolling rather than summing up arbitrary derivatives?
No, that's actually not true. You're thinking probably about the e to the second Schlüterel parameter.
No.
For the second Schlüterel parameter, it needs to be flat in the direction you're rolling. For the first Schlüterel parameter, every derivative has to be small. Okay, let me give you an example. If I here's a piece of paper, right? Suppose it looks like this. Okay, now it's flat in this direction, it's not flat in this direction. That's the end of the story, it's going to be fast roll, it's just Newton's law. So in fact, the derivative needs to be small in every direction, as far as the first derivative is concerned. And that is not true of the second derivative. No? Eta is very different. Eta you have to do with potential and constructive.
Okay,
Eta is a derivative.
I think that's fine.
Yeah. At the end of the day, epsilon really is up to a factor of three or something, the ratio in the Schlüterel approximation, the ratio of the kinetic energy to the potential energy. So the kinetic has everything. And then, at some point, we want to oscillate at some kind of minimum, and hopefully rigid the universe if this field is coupled to, for example, standard molecules. Now, again, that was just making up some potential. Where might this kind of Lagrangian come from?
What you're actually saying is just the gradient. The
gradient squared needs to be small.
The gradient in the field space.
In the field space.
Must be small.
That's right, in the field space. Okay. And so this point is essential to.
Of course.
I'll talk about that now. Thanks. Okay, so. I'm going to talk about this corner of string theory, type 2A theory, which involves all this kind of stuff in 10 dimensions. So there's a metric, GAB, there's some scalar field known as the dilaton, and then there is various field strengths, sort of generalized electric and magnetic fields. So for example, just as a point charge, sources a Maxwell 2 form, a string being a one-dimensional object, sources a Maxwell 3 form. And then there are these various other field strengths, which you can think of as being sourced by the various brains of the theory. But there are, but these things, in fact, you can turn on without being sourced by any brains, because they can wrap topologically non-trivial cycles in compact space. You can imagine a B field running around in torus. But there are, in fact, brains that we can turn on in a consistent way on the convective patients I'll focus on, which are these flabby owls that people like, so D6s and the sort of eagle cousins of O6 planes, which carry negative tension. Okay, so here's the 10-dimensional action, simple supergravity approximation, and it may look a bit scary at first, but it's kind of what you would guess. So the Einstein-Hilbert term is here, there's a kinetic term for the dilaton, and so the Maxwell kinetic terms for all these field strains. And then an integral over the world volume of the B6 brain and the O6 brain. Okay? Now this object here is just the bosonic part of the supergravity approximation, and added all the sort of fermionic structure of this supersymmetric theory. But since we're going to be searching for solutions with maximal space-time symmetry, since we're interested in inflation, those fermions are going to have zero value. Now there's also a bunch of sort of stringy quantum correction statistics which I have included. And we're going to stop with that. Let me tell you why.
So is that I'm just going to ask, is that obvious they're going to have zero verb?
I'm searching
for those solutions, right? I'm not interested in. There's a consistent solution where fermions are zero.
Okay.
Like some R-value cosmology. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for fermions to be on zero. I mean, you could talk about condensates of Seibach's time.
That's what I'm thinking.
Right. So we're going to explore that kind of possibility.
Okay, same thing.
Okay. We're just going for sort of canonical and sort of inflation.
I mean, okay, so this is some choice, but how much is this a choice and how much is this generic? Is action?
Yeah, so in this form, in fact, this is the supergravity approximation. The level of something that's consistent on the bloody axis, so classical approximation. So in the two-way limit, this is the list that you'll find from Kolchinsky, book on string theory, for example. So these are sort of the standard sources in the two-way sector.
It could be more sources or?
There could be more sources, for example, you could think like D8 frames and so on, which we don't know how to include consistently on a clavier. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What about this H3 and F? I mean, so you can have some other stuff?
So this is all you can have as far as these field strengths are concerned. The H3 is always there, it's sort of the field strength source by the string. And then there are these even dimensional guys that live in the type 2A theory, F0, F2, F4, and F6. It's all the things that you can that you can stuff into 10 dimensions. Right? You can't have like an F20, for example, because it won't fit in 10 dimensions. So those are all you have. So we're in the 2A room, this standard sort of sources. All right, so what's nice about this, and this is the reason why we're really interested in this, is because these sort of thin-dimensional actions typically can be compactified to 4 dimensions. It's a total mess. And for example, you have some volume, the compact space, which will act as a dynamical scalar field, and it will typically just roll away. And you won't have a compact space. But in these two compactifications, the world experience Cutchery-Taylor in 2005 and always stabilized all these fields in 4 dimensions. And this classical description in a way that's under complete parametric control on these bloody apps. So by parametric control, I mean that we'll be talking about the fluxes that live in the compact space, and if you take some of these fluxes to large values, you can dial all the quantum corrections that I ignored here towards zero, and this classical approximation becomes the entire description in that regime. Okay? And in fact, these models are at least partly interesting from the point of view of particle physics, because there's ways of incorporating intersecting grains to build interesting particle physics like the MSSM. Okay, but I'm going to be talking about just the cosmology of this kind of beast.
Do you stabilize them all, or is there one or two that are left, like the
So some of the axions are left.
So there's no breathing mode, that's it for the...
I'm sorry?
There's no breathing mode, like in PET QB, there's all the scalar modi, but in particular, there's the overall scaling of the metric?
The volume of the convex space?
Yeah.
In type 2B, classically, that's exactly right, that is left as a flat direction.
Oh, that's the flat.
In this case, it's not. So in type 2A, all of that is stabilized.
So there's no scalar variance to the classical equations?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, So in fact, that's an important difference between the 2B and the 2A. 2B, classically, is kind of uninteresting because you have these flat directions, as you mentioned, but they can be lifted by non-conservative quantum corrections and so on. In the type 2A case, which I'm talking about, all of it stabilized classically.
I guess I've spin it differently in the sense that for cosmology, you're looking for things that you just like to stabilize things, but you like to leave some of them that are lighter than other ones, so you can do some cosmology with them. So whether they're interesting or not depends on what you want to do, right?
So
why do you say that the flat directions are uninteresting phenomenology?
Oh, I don't even remember all the words I used in that sentence.
But you play it back for you.
In fact, to be, it is the case that the overall volume just has no stable direction classically. So it just expands and expands. And so you don't have a four-dimensional description anymore. It just expands to infinity.
Unless they have different perturbative.
Yes, so then you have to appeal to all that stuff. Yeah, then 2A, you don't have that. I would consider it a problem because you're
not. Because the inflation stabilized, right?
So, well, that's a question. But you're gonna have inflation eventually. Are you saying you're not going to have inflation?
So we're going to have stabilization. I'm going to be talking about descriptions which permit a four dimensional description at the end of the day. So there will be a minimum where all fields are stabilized. Okay. Now, that 10-dimensional object, fine, it's on.
You first.
One question about the previous slide. You were saying that you could parametrically tune it so that the classical action was all there was, and that the quantum corrections were parametrically small. Now, is that true as long as the fields are basically at their stabilized minimum, or does that remain true away from the minimum?
So it's true at the minimum, and then there's a question of how far. And then if you're near the minimum, it's true. It's just a question of how far you're prepared to go. Like there's some. You can ask a question about there's some parameter I'm dialing, so the quantum correction goes to zero, and there's some domain around that where it's valid. If I go too far away, then you don't have to worry about those corrections. But you can always dial the parameter such that that space is as big as you want.
You can, in particular, you can dial it to be big enough that inflation could, in principle, have taken place over that range.
Yeah. And a priori, there does not seem to be any barrier to that. But since I'm going to be proving it on no theorem, I mean, I don't know. So, yeah, a priori, that seems to be perfectly reasonable thinking about that. There's no reason why that should happen.
Is the story that there's a tension between the still normal condition and the condition that all the moduli are stabilized?
Tension between the existing.
That is, if you well stabilized all the moduli at string scales, then it's hard to satisfy the still normal condition because it's hard to have anything left over that's flat. Am I way off, or is that the?
Sorry, say it one more time, right? So the original statement was tension between spiral inflation and the ability to stabilize all the moduli.
Yes.
He's speculating about how your proof will go. He's saying, is it going to go that once you?
Oh, because I've looked at models which have stabilization, that's going to cause it hard to have inflation.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that's the way it's working.
It's not a simple story.
Yeah, I don't think it's that. Like for example. Okay, yeah, so some of these fluxes here that we turn on to achieve the stabilization, for example, I could just turn them off and then have no stabilization, and I will still not have inflation.
Oh, so it's worse than that.
Right, so it's not worse than you're thinking.
Okay, so in the four-dimensional description in the Einstein frame, we proved the description of Clavius as his fall, so Einstein gravity, and then a bunch of scalar fields, the dilaton that we inherited from 10 dimensions, the overall volume of the compact space, scalar field, and then all these other sort of Kähler and complex structure moduli are sort of packaged into this plus dot 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 here, and all we know is that their contribution is positive. And then all those other field strengths and gradients that I spoke about in 10 dimensions contribute some kind of potential function, beta phi. Okay, so that's the four-dimensional description, and that's kind of nice because that's roughly what we wanted to have something like inflation.
So can you tell a little bit more detail how you get V?
Yeah, I'll come to that.
Okay.
What do you mean by proved? And you mean you show them that like all the kinetic terms have the negative sign or something?
Like yeah, we prove that using like the just four-dimensional n equals one super bracket description. You can prove that this is positive, for example. And okay, you can it's slightly non-trivial, but you know, you can actually extract volume in the dilaton in a consistent way. Where you see it has this structure. Okay. Now, since I haven't really said anything about the trying to achieve inflation, like I haven't really said this is what I want to get something to be flat, this kind of approach might fail because you know you take a generic quantum field space, so you don't expect it to necessarily achieve inflation. For example, suppose you have a minimum, and you extend about a minimum, you get n squared phi squared, and you might think you have Linder's chaotic inflation, but that happens when phi is large, and that's when all these other corrections, that potential beta phi might come along and destroy it. So there are reasonable arguments why a generic quantum field space is probably not going to achieve inflation, and so perhaps we should search for some kind of symmetry to guarantee that, like these monotropy models, or perhaps we should just get lucky, so this is the game of appealing to large numbers. And so why might this approach work? Because well, we don't need inflation everywhere in field space, we just need it somewhere. And since you typically have, say, 100-dimensional field space to explore because of all these moduli, somewhere you might get slower off. So there's 100-dimensional also field space to explore.
So you don't have lambda 5 to the 4 term.
Lambda 5 to the 4. We can,
you don't have this differential moduli. Then it doesn't seem to have.
You're saying there's no n equals 0 in your sum.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was just putting in a non-normalized quotient.
Okay.
It's not too important. You can put in lambda 5 if you want.
Do you have it?
So this is just, okay, at the level of this description, that thing here is a cartoon. Okay, because I'm going to talk about the potential. I just want to give a flavor for people who I mean, there are people when I give this kind of talk who haven't thought much about how easy it is to get inflation. So I'm just making the comment that there's all sorts of complication in the potential which could spoil your achieving expert classification. And so the kind of potentials we'll have will in general be complicated messes with all everything you want, 5 or 4, whatever.
Do you have to calculate CNs?
In some models, yes. Okay. Like if you have a theoretical amplification, you can calculate the entire potential. So I'll give you an example. I'll just show you one. Okay, the Lenogre theorem will be easy to prove, actually. Without knowing the details of CNN. Okay. So now, suppose you explore this 100-dimensional field space and it doesn't work. Well, then you just start, well, you can imagine you're starting to change the fluxes. As you change these fluxes in the compact space, the energy function starts to change. And so you do some integral over a cycle in compact space, and your field strength, and that's some integer. This is a Dirac charge quantization condition. And suppose these integers have n different values, for example, 100, and there's 100 different cycles, that's 100 to the 100, or well, 10 to the 500, these are the kind of where those popular numbers come from. In fact, in these 2A models, some of these Fs can go off to infinity. So the n here can go up to infinity, which is even bigger than 10 to the 500. And now if that doesn't work, there are many millions of clavials at least to explore. So there's a lot of stuff here. And we explore this exponentially large number of these four-dimensional models for inflation. Okay. So here's an example. And so this is the whole thing with all the CNs and whatever. And so if you pick, say, a toroidal magnification, you can actually compute the whole thing. Okay, and you have some function that looks like this, and there's some regions where it's negative, some regions where it's positive. And what we start doing is numerically exploring this regulation. This is a simple example, because there's only about 14 fields here instead of 100 or so.
So fields are A's and B's, and what is T?
Yeah, A's and B's and... Sorry,
what is T? What is T?
These are just names for the fields. So some of them are, I don't remember what's what here, but some of them are complex structures, some of them are the Taylor moduli. You can, and then some of these deltas or whatever, I've called them these fluxes in the complex space. Okay, so this is just an example of what it looks like.
Are these fluxes all the scalar?
The fluxes are integers.
Oh.
The fluxes, once you integrate over a cycle of the complex space, you get some integers.
Okay.
That's what I mean.
And that's a supersymmetric potential. Is that you got that by squaring a superpotential and doing the usual rules?
Yeah, you can use the n equals 1 supergravity description. Right. So there'll be a point here in field space, actually, now you mentioned that, where it's supersymmetric. So the cosmological constant will be negative. But in general, this thing has many minima. Some of those minima may be positive or negative. I'll answer that question soon enough.
There was a single point of potential, right?
Yeah, there's a point here where you start to run into trouble with this.
What does it mean?
So on this particular, so there's some orbifold on this case, and so the orbifold has a singularity associated with this. But you can stay away from that point.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you some intuition for this potential, for those of you who haven't thought much about this, suppose you have a compact space, which is a two-sphere, you have some charge in the middle, there'd be an energy density on the surface, okay, electric field squared, which would be like Q squared over R to the 4. Okay, well, think of this as flux squared over R to the 4. If you have a P form, you get 1 over R to the 2P. So all these fluxes scale differently, and this tell you something very basic, which is that the energy density function my V of y is going to depend on, for example, the volume of the compact space. Okay? Now, we proved in fact that it has this structure, maybe using a Cato superpotential or direct dimensional reduction, then the Einstein frame potential has this form. Okay? So there's a contribution from the H3, from those FP forms, V6 and O6 planes. And I've made explicitly the dependence on the dilaton from 10 dimensions and the volume of the compact space. So I've made their scaling explicit. So, well, I'm going to derive this in front of you, but you can figure it out by all these kind of scalings or using for doing it rigorously. Okay, and so that's the dilaton of the volume, and so on. And then there are these numerators here, which depend on all the other 100 or so moduli that you're detailing on the structure. And so all that information I just packaged into this function that I call A. And but we know that each of these functions is positive, and there's a minus sign here, which is important to get stabilization.
And those functions don't depend on psi D and psi B only.
Yeah. So in general, these are hideously complicated functions that depend on all these other fields. But I've just made this part explicit for you. So that's in fact enough. So again, the potential has this form, and but it's important to note that the size are related to canonically normalized scalars by this exponentiation. And so here's a fact that you take this potential and you differentiate in the sort of the dilaton direction, and add to it some kind of derivative in the volume direction. That when you act this on each of these terms, you pull the thing back at you with a factor of 9. So for example, you take the derivative times the dilaton. The dilaton here, that's a factor of 2 times 3, which is 6. And then this guy acting on that once gives 3, and that's 9. And then you have some extra b, which is positive, and so you can bound this to be greater than 9 times the potential. And then if you divide throughout by the potential, assuming it's positive, okay, you get this inequality here. And this is some kind of linear derivative on the log of the potential. And you remember that's the kind of beast that shows up in epsilon alpha or gamma. So the potential cannot be flat simultaneously in the dilaton of both directions at the same time. And that, in fact, we proved epsilon is always bigger than 27 over 13, whenever the potential is positive.
And what happened to the negative term, the O6 term? Is it canceling the...
No, it doesn't cancel. In this inequality here, you take 3 of the dilaton guy, acting on that, you get 9.
Oh,
so some of these guys are positive and negative, right? They're all 9 times V.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah.
The sum over P of P V sub P is positive. Why is that? How do you know that? That's true.
Yeah, each of the big P's here is positive. Okay, so we know but we know that each of these contributions is positive. Okay? And we know that it's the O6 plane that carries negative tension and gives a negative contribution. So
and this cannot help you. The fact that the last term is negative doesn't help.
No, because it has a factor of 3 here, and that's enough that you just get that 9, so it doesn't help. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just a fact. Okay, so some of the bits here are positive and negative, but the overall thing is just 9 times the potential.
And the reason the A sub P, that's counting the contribution of the Maxwell term for these various fluxes that are P formed.
That's right.
Right. So that's just positive because those are
negative. Yes.
But let me this fluxes thing, I guess when you put fluxes, right, can you put more or less of those fluxes?
You have there's some integer when
you... So you're summing over all things. The amount of fluxes is not determined, is it?
You have some flux integer, and you have a number of these fluxes, and that amount is not determined, that's right. But the whole contribution is some positive quantity that I call it V sub P. Yeah, but indeed that depends on those fluxes. And so
And question about that, is this, if that's the proof, do you mind going back to it for a second? So I mean, what this is saying is that if you try to be at a stable point where the derivatives with respect to the dilaton and the volume were zero, you would only be able to do that if the right-hand side was zero, but the right-hand side is bounded above 9V, so you would only be able to do that at a point where V was zero, but then there would be, by definition, no inflation at a point where V was zero. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of false spelling out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, here, when you turn on some of these boxes, you'll find that V is in fact negative. For V equals zero case doesn't even occur. But anyway, it's more or less what you said. I'm just saying it's slightly different.
Well, maybe a related question. So before even you, I mean, can you show that there is any point where V prime is zero, so at that minimum in every direction, and with V greater than zero?
That point does not exist.
That would be because that would be epsilon equal. That exact decision.
That would be epsilon equal zero. So that's on this slide. So since the first sort of parameter is always large, there's no inflation anywhere in field space, regardless of what you would like to call the inflaton, whether or not you want it to be decay or modulus or public juncture. The volume and dilaton direction is essentially always spoiled the fun, and so there's no inflation. The corollary then is that an undersuited solution has an extreme form of slow roll. And this tells us something that just because you have many in vacua, that doesn't mean you get out anything. For example, here you don't get any inflation. So inflation seems like it requires some kind of structure. So the cosmology then is basically your field vector, whereas it starts in field space, it's going to quickly slow roll down to some ABS vector.
Well, but I mean, if you are getting that something is always positive, that means that potential is kind of unstable, right? That it runs off to infinity. Or
that's only when the potential is positive. So this allows for ADS vacuum. There are many ADS vacuum that exist in all points.
But cannot you get when at the point of V is zero, then what happens then?
V equals zero. What I showed you doesn't prove anything. Just could have a Minkowski vacuum, but in fact you don't have that either. But in these models, when you try to achieve stabilization as well, then it rules out V being zero at that point.
Mm-hmm. It passes the point.
Yeah, you always get negative potential.
So if you try to understand the assumptions that go into this, so the way you derive, so you wrote down the 10-dimensional supergravity around you. And then you said that you calculate from that a 4-dimensional action, and all you're really using is how the potential scales.
Yeah.
And so in principle, the way, and we'll do it all classically because you're collecting loops or something. So then if you're even at the classical level, in principle, what that would mean is actually taking the Kluge Klein modes, the massive ones, and solving their equation of motion as function of the massless modes, and then plugging them back in the action of the potential. Mm-hmm. But probably what most people actually do is not that, they just truncate. They throw all the Kluge Klein modes away. And so you can imagine the difference being scaling differently in the sense that all the masses that you're integrating out, the difference normally, the rationale for truncating is that the things that you're throwing away are suppressed by inverse powers of the Kluge Klein scale or something. But that depends on the volume and the dilaton, and so that might have scaled differently than the term you kept. You know, has anyone thought through what that correction is, or is there an argument as to why it doesn't contribute?
So at these, what we know is that at these vacua, these KK modes are suppressed compared to what's being kept here.
But they could be suppressed but scaling differently. They could be suppressed but scaling differently as a function of psi p and psi p. I don't know if that would change your inequality or not.
Well,
it's
saying they're suppressed. But you mean they're only suppressed for certain values of psi?
Well, so then I don't know if there's a sign that you get, or if it's just that if you now have V is close to zero, then the subdominant thing is the one that wins.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. That it could be that there's something there, that from the ADS vector I know about, they all look suppressed. Like in the simple models I looked at, like my torus, those guys really are suppressed. But in what you're saying, like insofar as even though the potential is maybe small, it's still dominant over the blood and poker. Mm-hmm. But there may be more complicated models where that breaks down, not 100% sure.
Okay.
I was thinking about this issue recently, but I haven't explored that. So, yeah, these KK modes can be the thing that gives us a question. That would be cool.
That would be cool.
Okay, so this level approximation, I guess, where we're not in this part of the landscape because it doesn't seem to have cosmology that's relevant to our universe. So, in some sense, inflation constraining the string here. Now, this is not meant to be doom and gloom for string theory or inflation. This is meant to be a guide to construct workable models. So, what you want to do is break this inequality somehow. And in fact, there are structures that can scale differently, for example, beasts like NS5 brains and non-geometric boxes and so on. Now, if they break this inequality, first of all, it doesn't guarantee you get inflation, because you might have more general no-go theorem. Now, but more importantly, why didn't we include them in the first place? Well, the point is that we don't know how to include these things in the hours as it stands, but this guides us to go ahead and try to tackle these less well understood beasts in this theory.
Yeah, so just a question for non-expert. The type 2B case, how does it evade this situation?
Yeah, so the type 2B case, there's a flat direction. You don't have stabilization at this classical level. So it already has a flat direction. Okay, so then whatever the quantum correction to that is, it's going to be the dominant thing, right? Because the classical thing gave you zero.
Right.
Here the classical thing is non-zero. So in the 2B case, in fact, you have flat directions, I think, to all orders in perturbation theory. And there's a non-perturbative correction, which dominates zero. But in this case, we already have something.
So why isn't your conclusion at this point to try to just, the guidance is to do physics with type 2B?
It's possible that that's better. I mean, for me, that is a possible way to do it. For me, I guess it might be a bit strange that some parts of the landscape are much better at getting inflation than others. Seems a little bit odd to me, but that's possible. And what I also like about these models is their absolute explicitness. And I think people argue...
Because you're doing everything at the classical level.
Yeah.
And there's great value in having shown that you can't... It's hard to get it in this whole region.
Sure. Oh, sure.
But are you familiar with Bowley-Shapiro-Shetter model of inflation?
Sorry?
Bowley-Shapiro-Shetter. It's sort of F-term inflation, right? Or D-term.
Oh, is this in... These are supergravity models in from
four dimensions. Models.
Is this in four dimensions?
Yes.
Well, there's lots of model building that you can do bottom-up model building.
No, but if you're not, then what happens there is that you are in supersymmetric breaking vacuum, which has a flat direction, and then you perturbatively calculate one loop and correction, and since it's already supersymmetric breaking vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
That correction is non-zero and gives you logarithmic potential, which very nicely drives inflation.
And so your starting point is positive energy that's flat.
Exactly.
Well, that for sure is a good starting point. That's not possible here.
But what I'm trying to say is that maybe something like this you can actually also construct in type 2A where you have this flat direction. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but these flat directions are related, yeah, so I'd have to construct a flat direction that was positive energy in the first place.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So you're saying that that's...
I think once you've achieved that first step, then it becomes options like the functions. Okay, and since we did this, it's been nice to see people follow up on this kind of approach with some sort of generalization to this kind of thing. How am I going for time?
Don't worry too much. It's your own deadline.
Okay. Well,
there's no more talks after you.
Actually, I'll give a second talk.
That's okay. So let me get to the second part relatively quickly. So this axiom of cosmology is kind of an old topic. I thought what we put in is sort of latest constraints on these axiom models relevant to inflation. Some people know a lot about these axiom models, but so try to stay away if you can. What I would like is that the difficulty of sort of string models to inflation is one's ability to connect to the low energy world around us. And as I said at the beginning, what if we had some kind of microphysical phenomenon that sort of naturally, if you will, reaches down from high energy physics and is relevant to low-energy phenomenon. And I think perhaps the most beautiful example of this is if you see the axion. And here we'll see inflation being important, and the question is, can this assuming an axion give some clues to inflation? Okay, so this strong CP problem, as you probably all know, there's a term in the QCD Lagrangian which goes like E dot E, where these are the Lorentz fields, and it has some coefficient theta, and this CP violating term generates an electric dipole moment for the neutron, which is being constrained to be incredibly small, consistent with zero, and the theta turns out to be, must be less than about 10 to the minus 10. In fact, the real statement is sharper than this, because in fact you have to combine this theta with an angle that comes from the determinant of the Clark mass matrix, so they must add up and be small. And so even after all these years, so the sort of leading ideas of how to explain this dynamically goes back to Peche Quinn and Weinberg and Wilczek, who introduced some new global U1 symmetry to the standard model. Okay. Some new field pi squared minus f a squared. For this f is the breaking scale, the Peche Quinn breaking scale, which, as we know, is in fact an incredibly high scale. So there's some potential here. And as a Goldstone boson that runs around them, that's going to be connected, that's going to essentially be the axion field. And what they did was they connected this to the standard model in such a way that it effectively promoted theta to a dynamical field, the axion. Now, this is that field being a Goldstone boson would be massless at the classical level, but quantum corrections from QCD itself give this potential here a slight tilt that generates a mass. And that goes like mentioned before, which is a QCD scale, something like this, 100 MeV or so. And when you rewrite this in terms of a canonically normalized scale, the mass you can easily show is just lambda squared over f. And since you know f is huge, this guarantees the axion mass must be very small. It's kind of like the seesaw mechanism for neutrinos. So here's that potential which breaks the symmetry generated by QCD instantons. And so theta starts off somewhere in the potential in the early universe, and then eventually goes down, oscillates, produces axions if you like, and then Hubble friction eventually causes it to settle down to zero. And that's the solution to the strong, well, that's a solution to the strong CP goal. If you believe this Peche Quinn symmetry is essentially exact modulo is broken by QCD. Okay, so the parameters I'm going to be talking about, there's the inflation scale, which we don't know. There's the axion, which has this breaking scale FA, which we don't know. And what regime are these kinds of beautiful models of the universe consistent, and what can we learn? Okay, so just very quickly, here's my parameter space. Energy scale inflation on this axis, on the Hubble scale, and the vertical axis is the Peche Quinn scale for the axion. And the axion mass, if you like, goes down this way. And first of all, we know that this very high scale inflation is ruled out. Okay, because that generates the Sitter fluctuations, which are those gravity waves that we would have seen by now. Now, for the axion, small values of the Peche Quinn scale are ruled out. Because in loops, the axion couples to standard model fields, not just the gluons. For example, it couples to photons in a slightly model dependent way. And it goes like phi over f, and so small f means strong couplings. This is dimension phi operator. In fact, the best constraints here come from the physics of stars, because in fact the axions provide a cooling mechanism, for example, for red giants that just emit axions.
Sorry, your axion is the inflaton here?
Oh, no, sorry. The axion has nothing to do with the inflaton.
So, what was the thing about inflation then? Why
is it? Okay, so at the moment, those rectangles, one's horizontal, one's vertical, have nothing to do with each other. So, we're about to get to that.
Okay.
So, we're going to see that this part of parameter space here essentially cares about assuming both at once. Yes. In the axion, as far as I'm concerned, has nothing to do with inflation, but may have existed during inflation, so we'll talk about that. So it is not the inflation. I mean, it's the one of the reasons that is the potential that it feels is at the QCD scale. That would be ridiculous if it's the inflation.
And because I use a problem area, it's not at all. So anyway, okay, so let's talk about this issue. So the axion is neutral and has a lifetime much longer than the age of the universe, or stable. And careful calculation that I'll sort of commit to you says that omega sub a, the axion contribution to the dark matter today, has this sort of form. So it goes like the initial theta squared, because that's what sets the initial energy density, you know, to fill in the old universe, even though today it has relaxed to zero. And we should average that over the sky in some way that we'll talk about. And then this depends on the Peccei-Quinn scale to approximately 7.6. Okay, these weird numbers emerge because you have to track the generation of the axion potential, okay, which is a thermal effect, which is not trivial to calculate, but it has this kind of scaling. And it goes like one, sort of this 1 over 10 to the 12 GeV or so. And this means if the Peccei-Quinn scale is large, say bigger than 10 to the 12, it seems like we're in trouble, we get too much axion diameter. So axions, of course, you know, as we like to say, the dark matter seems weird, but axions love giving you dark matter, it tends to be too much. Okay. So FA can be large, for example, could be related to gut scale physics, if theta happened to be small. Yeah, say 10 to the minus 2 or so. So to answer whether or not that's allowed depends on this distribution. So if the Peccei-Quinn symmetry gradient occurs after inflation, here's the story. So the axion field fluctuates between minus pi and pi on sort of relatively small scales. And so you have no choice but to declare that the average of theta squared is sort of pi squared over 3, and high FA is ruled out. Okay. But if the Peccei-Quinn symmetry gradient occurs before inflation, here's your axion field comes into existence when the symmetry gets broken, and then inflation does its thing, and you can see a 7-hour time coherentness, and so that's what you get. And so inflation homogenizes theta on superhorizon scales, and remember the axion energy density goes like this theta squared, so here it's 0.01 squared, or it's proportional to that number squared, here it's 2 squared or whatever. And so this unambiguously predicts, sort of, if you like, a multiverse of axion dark matter abundances, and if FA is large, most of these have way too, have much more dark matter than in our Hubble patch. Okay? But we may happen to be here, and that's acceptable in this model. Okay, so in this case, since we only care about our, since we can only see our Hubble horizon, the average of theta squared is just some number between 0 and 1 squared, so in fact it could be small, and high FA is allowed, for example, God scales are allowed in drop. Are allowed technically. And of course, you can mumble things about entropics as to why this, it might be favored that we live in this atypical volume with smallish amount of dark matter compared to the rest. And these are comments to that effect go back to Linder in 91 and recently Wilczek paper. And let me just comment very briefly. I think even today, Ben Fogel was giving a talk on this that he mentioned. And this takes the stomach in something which we have no clue is correct, which is the stomach particular measure on the multiverse. And so what he pointed out is if you take the log, the energy, this is our expansion history, so take log density versus log scale factor. And so this is our history. Here was the radiation era, then the matter era, and then dark energy. And the blue curve here is the baryon density. It was just redshifts like one of the scale factor cubed the whole time. And suppose this is our world. Well, another world which has much more dark matter, much more axion dark matter, looks like this thing. Okay, so it starts to be dark matter dominated for a much bigger era of time and stops at much later time. Okay, now these sort of favored measures on the multiverse say you're meant to count observers in your Hubble volume. And you meant to, and there's a critical time when you have most observers. They occur at matter dark energy equality. So you're comparing this point here in our universe to this point here in the other universe. And you can see what's different about them is not that they have different amounts of dark matter or dark energy, because by definition those are the same. They have different amounts of baryons. So this other universe has much less baryons. Okay? So if there are much less baryons, there may be less observers. And that's why we have to meet here. So that's some kind of rationale as to why this
we happen to be in this whole special level of longing, but, you know, this may or may not be right. Okay, so here's the logical skeptics. Here's the axiom of cosmology timeline, where I imagine, in this part of the talk, imagine FA is really large, and at that time, the axiom field exists because the symmetry is broken. And the physics of it depends on sort of the temperature associated with the inflation, which determines whether the symmetry is intact or not. So it may be before or after. Then eventually the axiom applies a mass, QCD scale, and eventually theta ratios to zero. So that's basically what I said, that this sort of, well, let me just go to the next slide. Okay, so the point is the following. There's a sort of a special curve here which I drew, the line here which I drew. Okay, and this is where I took the temperature associated with inflation, is the De Sitter temperature, which is h over 2 pi. And this is the curve where the Peltier-Kuhn scale equals that temperature. So above it, the Peltier-Kuhn scale gets broken by the time you enter inflation. And below it, the symmetry is still intact, and then gets broken. So up here, inflation and entropics, if you like, save the day, and you don't get too much dark matter. But in this corner, you're killed by too much dark matter.
Sorry, even in the entropic, isn't there an additional constraint just due to the fact that the field, no matter how anthropically small it was in that patch before inflation, it gets fluctuations from
the isotope to the acidic equation?
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, so what I said is you said there's a little cheat here that I pretend that theta was uniform, but as Leighton pointed out, this is a fluctuation next to the acidic fluctuations in the inflationary story. So they go like the acidic temperature, just h over 2 pi, is 1 over f. And importantly here, you see it depends on both these scales. It's huge if the scale inflation is big, and it's small if the Peltier-Kuhn scale is big. Now these are the isocurvature varieties, because at early times the axiom is essentially massless. Okay, so these fluctuations in this number density don't translate into density fluctuations, okay, at early times. And so since the scale you know is essentially adiabatic, then the isocurvature constraint is at most 10%, probably a bit less than that now. This constrains these models significantly. And so these are the constraints we found. And so this purple region here is what happens if you, is even if the axion abundance is negligible, you still have too much isocurvature in this region. The blue one says, well, you can't really claim the axion abundance is negligible because it has a distribution. And at the 95% level, at least 0.25% or 5% squared should be dark matter. And then if all the axions are dark matter, you kill the cyan region. Now, what can we learn in the future? So, remember, so there's a big search going on the gravity waves, and they've ruled out this region so far. Okay. Now, upcoming searches like Planck satellite and so on, you're going to push this down to around about here. Okay, so that's not going very far, but you might make a discovery there. And so then the axion has to be in this window. Sometimes called the desert of particle physics, about 10 to 11 or so GeV. That's a bit hard. It's actually not true, but you get streaming models down there, which tend to prefer sort of gut scale models up here somewhere. And if that were right, the scale of inflation would have to be very, very small, much smaller than you can probe with gravity research. Okay. Now this line here is indicating that what happens if you increase the accuracy of isocurvature, constrain isocurvature even more. You could possibly make a discovery, although you would have to get lucky because for some reason you happen to be there. Okay. So there are these sort of two possibilities, or otherwise something's just very much amiss in our story of inflation or the axiom. The inflation energy scale has to be very low, or the PQ gradient scale has to be in the desert of particle physics. But it's plausible we can figure this out if Planck observes isocurvature, there you go, or if Planck observes gravity waves, it would be that story. It's at least consistent. So let me finish. So fully understanding, or some understanding of the mechanism behind inflation and its connection to fundamental physics will require inputs from all sorts of points of view, from string models. We saw that inflation places constraints on string theory, providing a guide to construct our place in the landscape, if anywhere. And in this axion story, we saw it establishing correlations between other fields like axions and fluctuations from inflation like classic curvature is very exciting. But you know, suppose Plank comes back and sees a little bit of evidence for axial curvature fluctuations. It seems a bit premature to declare victory and say that this must have come from Boas-Kell inflation. So let me leave you this final thought. You know, there's a direct search going on for axions on the Earth. One of the leading ones is this 18x search. And that's in this little window here. Okay. You don't know about inflation. And what they're trying to do is go down in the classic window, okay, and try to make a discovery. But it's plausible to go the other way and try to go up. Okay, although that's difficult because the axion couples like 1 over f, so going up is hard. But you could imagine going up a little bit, and maybe with new ideas we could go up. And you could imagine making a discovery there. Okay, is that here somewhere? You could also imagine discovering some isolated curvature and null results from gravity wave searches. And that together paints a consistent picture that not only do axions exist and that there's some fraction of dark matter, that inflation occurred and it's at very low scales, but that we happen to live in a special Hubble volume, which is sort of tangible evidence for our multiverse. And I'll finish there. Okay, thanks.
So I'm very confused with your estimate of theta square. Yeah, I mean, look, as far as I know, for example, cosmological perturbations, W map measures the amplitude of cosmological perturbations, which are given also by h divided by 2 pi, right? And that is, or there's also this epsilon thing, right? And of course, that also quantity fluctuates, but I think the amplitude is simply as it is predicted, right? I mean, there is no...
These are the adiabatic fluctuations?
Yeah, I'm talking about adiabatic. So why should... if you have the mechanism that predicts, that is also like amplification, vacuum fluctuations in inflation, why shouldn't you be able to relate theta squared to Hubble scale uniquely without any, without choosing any random
theta squared to Hubble scale? Are you talking about fluctuations?
Yes.
Yeah.
You give us these little circles. Yeah. I mean, I don't understand the little circles.
Background or situation.
Why cannot you just fix this and calculate from the inflationary scale?
Calculate, what do you want to calculate? I'm sorry, you want to go to the background?
Your contribution to the energy density coming from axion fluctuations.
Contribution to the total energy density of the
universe. Yeah, dark matter energy density, that's what I mean. Why do you need some anthropic reasoning for that?
I think there's a question of background value versus fluctuations. The fluctuation you can compute, but the background value is...
Yes, the background value can't compute.
So the IH over F, that's the computation.
That's the background value.
No, that's the fluctuation.
No, this was, I meant this like standard deviation in theta. Mm-hmm. So this 0.01, let's go to a lesser value. Oops, that wasn't, or whatever. Yeah, so there's some background value, mm-hmm. which I've pretended is 0.01 everywhere. There's little wiggles on top of this thing, which is set by this.
But why is the background value important?
Oh, because that sets the background amount of the dark matter.
Right.
So if you forget about the fluctuations altogether, right? The axion falls in its potential, has this zero mode, it fluctuates in its potential. Okay, and the energy density stored in that depends on the initial energy density in your potential. Well, yeah, so if you were just talking.
But don't you generate dark energy just from fluctuations of the
axion?
Dark matter, sorry.
First of all, we have to talk about the zero mode. So here's the axion potential. And this potential is really 1 minus cosine theta or something, or say approximately theta squared if theta is small. And so the initial energy density here depends on where theta happens to start in the universe.
Yes.
So let's focus on the zero mode, homogeneous. And so this energy density eventually starts redshifting, oscillating, and that's what you call dark matter. And that depends on your initial theta. So the energy density in X and dark matter is proportional to this.
Why don't you call dark matter the fluctuations?
Well, these fluctuations.
Quantum fluctuations, that's what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, couldn't I ask the same question for any adiabatic fluctuations? I mean, you wouldn't call the dark matter. I mean, if you have this dark matter, and there's 10 to the minus 5 little fluctuations on top of that.
Yes.
And that there's a whole procedure as to how to talk about that in a sensible way, but there is this background amount of dark matter. I'm not sure.
So I don't think answering the question. A few more questions, but I think if this you can discuss a little bit.
Yeah, perhaps we should talk about that.
Yeah.
You're
probably asking a good question, but I just.
Yeah,
we had a question.
Yeah, so I'm interested in these anthropic arguments related to the axion because I've never really thought them through. So if measurement showed we were in the region that you pointed to, then well, you just went right by. Okay, there. Okay. So supposing that measurement found us to be there. Then it would require then to understand that within the context of the models that you've been discussing, it would require an improbable value of an initial condition for the axion field.
Yes.
Okay. But what I want to know is we have a long list of parameters related to initial conditions and other parameters related to the standard model that we already know have improbable values. Is this of a different kind, and that leads people to speculate about multiverses, et cetera. Is this the same argument again? So is it the 31st version of the same argument again, or is it a qualitatively different argument? Say then the argument about the cosmological constant or the proton neutron mass difference or
well,
a heat scale or a long list of other improbable parameters we want to explain.
Well, in this case, in some sense, different to all the other cases, is that I write down what appears to me to be very sensible Lagrangian. Okay, I have a standard model, add to it these extra terms that implement the Pacheco symmetry. At the end of the day, I have scalar fields rolling around, and that theory predicts unambiguously that the dark matter varies from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't, when I set up a standard model, it doesn't tell me that Yukawa couplings vary from place to place. This model does predict that. And so to me, what makes it special is that the dark matter advances varies from place to place is an unambiguous prediction of the theory. So you have no choice. You have to say that the amount of dark matter is statistical.
Right.
So you can't avoid that.
Right. So either the prediction is wrong, or there are regions outside our horizon where the dark matter has different density.
Yeah.
So that's the conclusion.
Yeah, but then you would. I think if you made a discovery up here, right, and you would say, well, all these other regions out there have much more dark matter than ours, and the fraction of the universe of the entire universe, which has the right amount of dark matter, is 0.001% or something, you start to think that's a bit strange.
Yeah, but it's already the case. So here's what, when I say, is it the same? I don't want to say this isn't a serious issue, this is a serious issue. It's already the case, for example, that for inflation to happen, the initial conditions have to be smoother than you would expect from random initial conditions in the patch that inflates. So there's already the same argument already exists with respect to inflation in general.
Mm-hmm.
That's Andre's argument of chaotic inflation. So this is the same argument. What I'm trying to get at is the difference between that's an interesting argument and we take, we think about it, and the difference between that and, in some sense, taking the evidence for inflation in our past as evidence for the existence of other regions outside the horizon. That is, to what extent can we argue from the existence of inflation in our past to eternal inflation, or to the existence of a much larger universe where the potentials are very different from what we see. So it sounds like the same argument.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, so there you brought up the issue of initial conditions, right?
Right, so this is an issue.
So the inflation problem is plagued by this problem of initial conditions for which we don't know.
Right.
But here the initial conditions are set in stone. because we know that based on causality arguments, it is going to vary from one hollow batch to the next, and then it's going to expand. So the initial conditions in this case, we know it has a statistical distribution, which we know, and that makes me interested in studying those kinds of models where I actually know the distribution. And you're talking about other phenomena with distribution, I don't know what it is.
Okay, so that's very good. Thank you. That's very good.
It seems like another qualitative difference is that in inflation, you might imagine that the here in the early universe, the axion had a totally flat potential. It was only at late times that it developed, you know, developed a potential, so you could determine where its minimum was. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of hard to imagine that any mechanism would know how to put it there deterministically in the early universe. Whereas with the infinite potential, at least maybe you can imagine that some mechanism, I don't know, you know,
The difference in scales points to there being no explanatory mechanism. But again, there, in the context of eternal of chaotic inflation, there is the same argument has to do with the whole standard model. But it's very difficult to think of anything, of any mechanism that would put the parameters in a special place where the neutron proton mass difference was on the order of the electron mass. So.
Yeah. Surely are those arguments. I mean, you're talking there about things that are speculative because we have no clue as to how the parameters of standard model vary, if either at all.
Okay, very good.
Just two questions on this, on the isocurvature constraints. I think I understand why, even if theta is really, really small, so that the axion contributes a negligible fraction to the total energy density of the universe. It's very, it's not the dark matter. It's a itty-bitty fraction of the dark matter. How then are you able to rule out so much parameter space from isocurvature modes, even though the dark, I mean, who cares if the axion is fluctuating if it's a totally negligible component of the dark matter?
Yeah, because although the zero mode is essentially zero, there are fluctuations around that.
Right, so that's the purple region there is the region where it doesn't even matter where you started. Your quantum fluctuations are pushing you up so high that even if you start from zero, even if your mean value is zero, your quantum fluctuations are high enough to create that much isocurvature.
The other
question I had is, what is going on? You've got a kink in your isocurvature bounds. What's going on at 10 to the 18 GeV?
So, well, I'm not going to attempt to derive for you on 10 to the 18, and tell you the reason. When you track the axion, there's a point at which it starts falling into potential. Right? That's when the Hubble parameter drops below the mass of the axion. Now, the question is, what's happening at that point? This potential here is actually temperature dependent. Okay, so this potential may be still undergoing the QCD phase transition and is rising, which is actually the standard story here. And then, if the perpetuated twin scale is really high, the axion mass is really small, and it's so small that it takes a long time for the Hubble parameter to eventually cross it, and this is the QCD phase transition has already stopped. So it's actually connected to the fact that if you, this height here, or just think of the mass of this thing, think of the mass, the axion as a function of temperature. It essentially, temperature going this way, this is the early universe. It essentially starts at zero and it rises. This is sort of around about, say, QCD time, and then it eventually stops. There's a kink in that distribution.
Okay, and so the kink in your isocurvature constraints comes from whether you're totally in the fixed mass range or whether you actually see some of this tail with masses still growing.
Yeah, so this bit here is actually this bit here. Way up there, you have to go to really high scales and the actual mass is really low, that the QCD phase transition has already finished by the time the Hubble parameter drops below.
Okay. So that 10 to the 18 GeV, that somehow comes from the QCD scale or that's what's
the QCD scale is in here.
And some combination of QCD scale and something else, I guess.
I guess the Planck scale is in there because we're talking about comparing the Hubble rates.
Okay, that gets
it. Yeah, I think it's It's sort of the Planck scale times some lambda to some smallish process, roughly around the Planck scale.
So, any more questions? Leighton, you look like you have a question.
No,
you're fine. Okay. So, if there's no other questions, let's thank Mark again. Mark's going to be here for the next 30 minutes, so if you want to ask any questions, this is the chance.